Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Holly Neer. For over 35 years, Neer has been an outspoken activist for peace and human rights, as well as a singer, songwriter, producer, and teacher. She's made over 24 recordings and has collaborated with the likes of Pete Seeger, Ronnie Gilbert, Arlo Guthrie, and Chris Williamson. Her current CD is called Show Up, recorded on Neer's own label, Calico Tracks Music. I'm speaking to Holly Neer by phone from her home in Northern California. So, welcome to the show, Holly Neer. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's nice to be invited.
Listen, I know that in addition to being in the entertainment and music business for over 35 years, you've also been a tireless human rights and peace activist. Did you come from a political family?
I did. I grew up in a small rural town, a farm town in Northern California, and my parents were kind of unusual in that town. They were left of center and really enjoyed talking about the world. So we grew up listening to them who at the table. They'd get up at 4 in the morning and get chores done and then come in about the time we were getting up, and we'd hear them talking about the world. So the idea of critical thinking and debate and discussion and thinking it through was part of our morning breakfast. Hmm. And they also really liked music and theater, so we, although we didn't have a television, we lived way out in the country, and at first we just had a generator, and then later on we got electricity, and my dad was interested, and he had a record player, and when stereo first happened, he set that up, and so we had a lot of opportunity to make music with pianos and accordions and flutes and drums and everything around. We entertained ourselves rather than turning on the TV.
It sounds like a wonderful era.
It was good.
Yes.
I think children certainly benefit from technology today in a most extraordinary way, but there is something lost, and I think the families who have figured out how to have a little of both mm-hmm. are doing really pretty well,
mm-hmm.
Making sure that there's quiet time for children to be creative, just to have a pad and some crayons and paints, and it's something really different about doing your own creativity rather than just observing other people's creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that brings me to my next question. I understand that you sang in public for the first time at the age of 8. What were the circumstances?
Well, probably 4 in a Methodist church where I was a little star in the Christmas thing. But this, 8 years old was the first time I actually stood on stage and sang a solo. Well, interestingly enough, it was a talent contest that was put on by the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Mm.
And I auditioned, and I got chosen, and then I was in the show, and I sang a cappella a song from Oklahoma, the song, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning.
Oh, yes.
And while I was doing that, a teacher sitting in the audience who had come to support some of her students heard me and came up and talked to my parents about if and when I ever wanted to study, she'd be happy to have me as a student.
Wow. And so you caught the bug.
Shortly after that, I began to work with her. I'm sorry, what'd you say?
So you caught the bug from that moment on, I assume.
Yeah, and my older sister already had the bug. She was a dancer, actor, and I think it somehow was in all of our blood. 3 out of the 4 of us became performing artists, and the mm-hmm. fourth one might have if he'd, you know, decided he had a lot of talent, but he just didn't feel like being a performer. But we were given a lot of gifts, and, you know, then after that, you look at young people who are trying to make a decision of what to do with their lives. You're given a certain amount of natural stuff, but it's what you do with it that becomes your life.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who were given talent, but not a whole lot, but they were given the gift of working really hard and really knowing how to practice.
Yep.
And they took what little they had, and they worked it into something really profound and powerful. There's other people who had a lot of talent, but they couldn't sit still for 3 minutes to rehearse or do anything, and they just, you know. So it's one of those mysteries that one has to open one's own doors as you're going mm-hmm. along in life and peek around corners and see what life holds for you.
Uh-huh. I think you've made quite a good choice. And I know you did some film and TV work early on, and I surprisingly even heard that you were in a Broadway production of Hair. I hadn't known that about you. But tell us why you decided to segue into just doing music primarily.
Well, the natural turn of events after going to school and was I had wanted to be a Broadway artist. I had to study dance and music and theater in hopes of working on Broadway. But that was really where I was headed. It's just that the anti-war movement was exploding around me, and a lot of my peers were involved in social change activism, early women's movement, the farm workers were very organized in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that all very interesting, and I started writing some songs about the world, and people liked them. And there's something about being liked that is very very seductive.
That's exactly right, yes.
Yeah, so people kept asking me back, oh, sing that one, oh, sing that one. And I'm not sure that I would have had the focus or the wherefore-all or whatever, the compassion to become a political activist just for that sake, because I really was determined to be a singer.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is the audience liked my social change music. And while I was doing that, I was also continuing to audition for things in Hollywood. But the parts that I was getting were rather shallow compared to what was going on in the world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember you were in some horror film or something, right?
I was in a couple really bad movies. I was in two really good ones. I only talk about the good ones. I had a tiny little part in a Cassavetes film called Minnie and Moskowitz.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that was really wonderful, just to get to work with him as a director. Most of my part ended up on the cutting room floor, but I, because he made 9-hour movies and then went, oh, right, I have to cut them down to two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I ended up on the floor because my part was not plot-driven at all. But I loved working with him. And the other was a George Roy Hill film called Slaughterhouse-Five, which I think turned out to be one of the best anti-war films that's been made. So those were really great experiences. And I did a lot of sitcoms, and I enjoyed them as well. I have to say I was guest spots on The Partridge Family and Room 222 and All in the Family and The Bold Ones. But what you can do in a half hour in a sitcom, is, especially if you're a guest part, is not very deep. So when the real world came along and said, we'd like you to be part of this. We would like to hear you. Come sing here. Get this opportunity. It just kept slowly taking me farther and farther away from the film and TV world until I had a bunch of songs, and I went to various record companies, and they were willing to talk to me about my music career, but they didn't really want to record those songs.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what some of your early songs were about. Were they anti-Vietnam?
Yeah. I had gone on a trip called the FTA Tour, which stands for Free the Army. It was an early group of entertainers that took the writings of soldiers who were resisting the war and racism from within the military and turned them into sketches. And we toured around the U.S. and then over to the Philippines and Okinawa, Japan, Hawaii, where men were and women were stationed. And we were like the opposite side of the Bob Hope show. And I got a chance to do that, and it took me out into the world. I got to learn about war from what I think are the two experts about war, the soldiers and the people whose countries are being occupied.
Mm.
And having conversations, in particular with the women in the occupied countries, and then where the U.S. bases were sitting right on top of their land and their culture and their heritage and their opportunity. And then to talk to the soldiers who were coming back from Vietnam saying, what the government says is going on and over there is not what's going on there. So that was a huge education for me. And there's a film out now called Sir, No Sir, which documents that period of time to try to remind people that the resistance of the soldiers in the military was a big part of why the war against Indochina ended.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
mm-hmm.
of soldiers just stopped fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're seeing the beginning of that in the current wars that are going on, where soldiers are just going to step back and say, I thought I was defending my country, but hey, that's not what this looks like.
Yeah, we're even hearing some of that now. I've heard soldiers speaking out on the media and stuff.
Well, I recommend this film because it's very inspirational. And those were the guys, predominantly guys, some women who I was singing to. So I wrote a lot of songs on that trip, and I came back, and they were the songs that made up my first record, which was a record called Hang In There,
mm-hmm.
1972. But the record industry didn't really want to record those songs, so I started my own label, quite naive about what that means. And people tell me now, in hindsight, that I was probably one of the first independent artists to start a record label.
Well, that's what an independent woman, especially.
Yeah. There may have been, somebody told me, and I wish I knew more about her, that there might have been a black woman in Philadelphia in the somewhere between the 30s and the 50s that did that, but it was just not what was happening. Now, of course, mm-hmm. it's happening a lot.
Oh, yes.
But it's
women.
A good thing I didn't know what I was doing, or I wouldn't have done it.
Listen, I want to play an excerpt from a song from your 2000 CD, Edge. It's called I Ain't Afraid.
Uh-huh.
I
Now that's like so many of your songs. It sounds like an anthem. To tell me what provoked that song. It's about religion.
It is. Anthems are interesting because I don't ever sit down to write an anthem. The listeners decide if it's an anthem because it has to do with how many people resonate with the message and have an emotional resonance to it. And that seems to have happened with that song. It's being sung all over the world by a lot of people in lots of different languages. And the Klezmatics, for example, they did a cover of it, and they sing it in both English and Hebrew. So I love that it's been an important song to people. I think what the song is trying to say, which is oftentimes missed in the first hearing, is not that I am being critical of someone having their own God.
Right.
But rather, I, along with many people who do live in this particular time in our lives, are seeing that God is being used against humanity, and that God is being used as an excuse or a rationale to commit horrific crimes against humanity and against the planet, and that we have to be able to separate that. Now, I don't happen to be a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist or a Muslim or a witch or any number of spiritual or religious identities. I just don't have that. I guess I'm pretty comfortable with the unknown, and I'm curious, and I wake up every morning, and if possible, in a state of awe and wonder that we're on this planet, the only one we know of that has life on it like this, and spinning through space at an unimaginable rate of speed. All of that's true, and if that's what makes up, if one wants to call that spirituality, then that's good. But I don't try to ever use my relationship to life as an excuse to do damage.
Yeah.
And so I think that
there's
song is calling on people to be very, very careful about that. Because we can, even if you take it back and look at the early part of the lesbian and gay community, there was a tendency out of fear of having been so hurt, having been thrown in mental institutions, having had lobotomies, having been killed in backstreet alleys, having been disinvited to family, all of those things makes a person and then a group of people who identify around that very defensive. And there was a time when that pride started to happen, where we started to get out of that and say, wait a minute, I'm not bad or evil or sick or terrible or any of those things. I am healthy and wholesome and loving, and that was all part of the pride movement. Mm-hmm. There is a tendency sometimes to get so prideful that you can start to put down anybody who isn't you.
That's right.
Or
isn't
like you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's required in order to be strong enough. You know, that kind of arrogance or that kind of pridefulness is required in order to be strong enough to face the dangers at hand.
Mm-hmm.
But then one has to be very careful not to take that over the edge and start to become like the oppressor.
Exactly, and I understand that too. In the gay and lesbian movement, there was a little bit too much pride sometimes, but one needs to take back.
To get to that courage level.
And to take
same
back
thing
your
for
humanity.
women who got strong enough to confront domestic violence and hate-based thinking and fear-based thinking started to be kind of anti-man some of the time when what they meant to be was anti-sexism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
it was a way to take back your humanity.
Yeah, so you just, we don't want to blame the victims.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to see in ourselves, in each of us, that there's a balance. There's a place where we come and we have to go, okay, make sure that I'm not imposing my hate and fear-based thinking on the world. Mm-hmm. The world cannot afford it anymore. Maybe it never could.
I don't think it ever could, yeah.
But it's part of one's own everyday vigilance is to have strong belief systems, to care. The new CD I have is called Show Up.
And I'm going to play an excerpt from that bit later. Yes, yes, absolutely.
I think I called it that because I really wanted, if everybody woke up in the morning and went out onto the street and identified, I think we would see that there are more people who want this planet to keep spinning, who want children to be fed, who want the schools to be subsidized, that want there to be health care, who want to keep living in a peaceful way and have diplomacy be put forth before war.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that if everybody went out and you had to pick one little flag or the other, and it wasn't a national flag, it was a peace and humanity flag or war and take the planet out, there would be more people holding the peace flag.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in this time, we have to quit breaking it down into so many little categories that we are afraid to identify. As many of us as possibly can muster up the strength and the courage not to do great, huge, magnificent things. We're not all going to be able to all be Cindy Sheehan, but to hold one of those two flags, and the one that we hold loud and clear, whether it's a bumper sticker or a button or just talking to our neighbors or our people, is to say, I do not support war and destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not. And then you can take it to another place, which is, of course, requires more courage, but that is to say, and I am the employer of the president, and he's not doing a good job, and I'm going to fire him.
I wish more people thought that. I think about that all the time. We are the employers of all these politicians,
yeah.
And our voices are not being heard, and a lot of us are getting incredibly uneasy about this.
And we should, because if we remain silent, that we could already great environmental damage has been done, not to mention thousands of, you know, more. In war nowadays, more civilians die than soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they send all the soldiers off to a little battlefield somewhere. It's right in the middle of town.
I know the structure of the world and the place where we commit war has changed. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
We cannot afford it, no matter what one's belief system is. And I just really encourage people to take that very seriously. And not to be thrown off by thinking that if you take a position, you're going to get dragged into some huge political debate that you don't feel like you can hold up under.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people feel, well, they can't debate, that somebody attacks them with a lot of information and they crumble. And I understand that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you can just hold on and say, I don't care what your rationale is. I'm going to hold on to the peace flag that says,
let's
make sure the planet survives.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, if you want to argue with me about anything, go argue to somebody else. I'm holding on to that position. And there's nothing you can say that can rationalize war in these times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we have to hold on to, even if you don't feel strong enough to go into some long debate about Iraq or Israel or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
call it nonverbal resistance instead of nonviolent resistance. Yeah.
It's okay to not know why to explain it, except that in your heart, you know that you don't think war is what mature, intelligent, caring planetarians do.
Yeah.
And
you know, you have an uncanny ability to walk that fine line between preaching and actually connecting with your audience. And I'm not sure how you do that, but you do it so well.
Well, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's part of your being a teacher, perhaps. Yeah.
Well, and music is such a great friend in that. I mean, of course, there can be really bad, boring, rhetorical, political music.
Oh, we have all heard some of that, yes.
We've heard some of that. But when one allows the music to take you to a higher place rather than drag you down, it's a wonderful kite string to hold on to.
Very powerful.
It just lifts you right up. And I guess people in your audience may know, but we're coming to your neck of the woods. And
I was going to mention that at the end of the show, yes.
Great.
I had heard that rumor. But in the meantime, I do want to play an excerpt from your most recent CD. It's called Show Up, as you said. And the song that I want to play is I Am Willing.
Mm.
So let's listen to a little bit of that.
And there is wailing the whole
I find this such a gorgeous song, Holly, and people seem so discouraged, at least in my circles, and this song is healing and it's encouraging. Tell me about it.
It's one of those songs that just kind of came out of me.
Did it come out recently?
A couple years ago, yeah. It was in response to my own cynicism. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I write songs to speak to that voice in myself that wants to...
Give up,
mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And I looked back over history, and I see people who have made the way so that we got to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, especially people, I think, who are elders in training, which I think I am, we need to be willing to say, whoa, I got some really great years out of this visit to the planet, and now it's time for me to find various ways to stand between children and harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
And to allow myself to be in that place. And right now, when I look out and at audiences, I talk to people afterwards in shows or emails I get, I feel like hopelessness is really deep.
Mm-hmm.
And
I see it too.
I just feel like if people can, every time they feel hopelessness, say they are giving a gift to the destroyers, take that gift back from them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't
mm-hmm.
let them have our hopelessness, because when they have our silence and our hopelessness, we give them a wide open door
mm-hmm.
to go right on through.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm really glad you wrote that. I was delighted to hear that, because, you know, one does become discouraged by what's happening in this culture and in this country.
Yeah.
So.
And you know what? It's okay to be discouraged. It's sad to be defeated by it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We can have our feelings. We can be lonely. We can be angry, we can be discouraged, we can be hopeless. I'm not telling people to stuff all those feelings, but to not necessarily suggest that those feelings then equate giving up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I like your line, to be hopeless would seem so strange, because it would to me as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an activist all my life as well, so I know this is a time when we really are up against the wall. This is the strangest era.
Well, and we don't know what's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't hold this time, if each of us, if you just sort of picture for a minute, putting your hand out in front and saying, I'm part of billions of hands out there who are holding this moment. And if we all hold it, something might happen that we can't possibly expect or imagine that would change the whole paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And if we pull our hand back and we just let it all slip, we could just, you know, look like a house of cards. One hand could rock the balance. And, for example, if we had newspapers that we bought every day, that the whole front page was success stories, just that would change our day
mm-hmm.
so much. But
it would be inspiring, yeah.
It would be very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, these people closed down that Walmart, and these people did that, and these people did this, and these people planted a billion trees, and these people... And it would just be a really different way to start our day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like there's a man out there, Paul Stamets, I think his name is, who does work around mushrooms. And he's finding all kinds of things, all kinds of qualities that may get us out of a jam, like mushrooms that may be able to eat toxic waste.
Mm.
Well, a little while ago, a person could have given up and said, why should I bother anymore? The toxic waste is going to destroy the planet. But along comes this young whippersnapper and is figuring out that there may be a solution to toxic waste.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just hate to be the citizen that gave up too soon.
Exactly. I agree with you. I agree with you. Listen, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you really quickly. I know you teach songwriting. Do you encourage people to write political songs, or do you encourage them just to write their heart?
I think if they write their heart, they will write a political song.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I think political has been used actually by the right wing to separate those of us out and make us be fringe participants in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the moment you write a political song, as witnessed by the Dixie Chicks, you get creamed.
Exactly. That was such a horrible thing.
But it's not a right-wing political song that gets creamed. It's a left-wing political song.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't ever call right-wing music political. They call it American
mm-hmm.
or Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it gets a little different title. So the only time they call a song political is when it's leaning towards humanitarianism, towards the left. It's a way of isolating us
mm-hmm.
and making sure that we don't get airplay, or making sure that we don't, you know, that our records don't get bought. But when somebody really writes a song and they tell a story, a really true story about their life, and they dare to write about something other than just romance, although romance is wonderful to write about, but there are other things in the world to write about, it can be an important form of communication to one's audience because you can see in people's faces a kind of, oh, right, I felt that way, or, oh, yes, that happened to me. Or
It's validating, yeah.
Like Cheryl Wheeler, she's not really considered a political writer, but I find so much of her material, my heart just goes, oh, wow. And I've sung several of her songs.
Mm-hmm. We are actually almost out of time. Tell us where you're going to be performing in our area.
I'm going to be in Albany the 6th of October and mm-hmm. Syracuse on the 7th.
Ah.
And you can go to my website, hollynear.com, and not only find my tour schedule, but it's where you can get access to my CDs. I've put out several collections of material that I've recorded over the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And a book that I have called The Great Peace March is there. And then there's a section called Art and Activism that you can kind of journey through and around. And also a photo gallery. So
it's a wonderful website.
Do you like it?
Yes, I absolutely
do.
Okay. Yes, I would highly recommend it. And I would highly recommend people going out and buying some of Holly Near's music. It's wonderful stuff.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much, Holly, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.